I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to our seminar on recent advances in hematologic oncology, specifically this four-part webinar series on what happened at ASH. This is part two. Today, we're going to focus on Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma and what happened at the ASH meeting. We have an outstanding faculty, Dr. John Kuravia from University of Toronto, Dr. Mike Williams from the University of Virginia, and Dr. John Leonard from Weill Cornell Medical Center. If you're into audio programs, check out our new podcast series, Oncology Today, including a recent program with Dr. Tanya Siddiqui on CAR T-cell therapy, something that we're going to be talking about today as well. But today we're here to talk about ASH and what happened at ASH as it relates to lymphoma. These were the original topics we covered in our seminar. I also met with each of the faculty people to have them do a presentation that we recorded, and I interviewed them afterwards, and those are all posted online. But these are the topics we're going to talk about today, except we're going to focus now on what happened since that seminar in terms of what happens at ASH. So actually, before I get started, I just want to take a breath before we start running down what already has happened and start with you, John Leonard, and ask you any thoughts about where you think we'll be next ASH. What's going to be happening this year that you're most looking forward to? What are some of the things that we've seen some tantalizing hints of that you're really looking forward to seeing over the next year, John, in terms of lymphomas? Any thoughts?
I'm excited about bispecific antibodies. I think that we'll touch on some of them today, but there were four of them presented at ASH. They're all active. I think they're easier to use than CAR T cells. So many of us who don't give CAR T cells ourselves will be able to use them. And I think they work. So I think we'll certainly be hearing more and more about those agents going forward.
So John Kay, you know, I joke when we do our solid tumor programs that whenever we do a hemoc program and I go, what's the most exciting thing? No matter what it is, everybody says bispecific. So, and actually now I think they're coming into solid tumors. I saw an EGFR one in lung cancer. But John, beyond that, any other areas of interest, any things that you think maybe are close to coming to practice?
Yeah, I think the other big thing certainly is going to be the evolution of CAR T-cell therapy, both earlier into the disease course in the curative setting and in newer indications. So we've seen data from the ZUMA platform as an example, but the randomized trial ZUMA-7, which is testing CAR T against autologous transplant, will hopefully read out in 2021, and we might get an answer about moving the ball forward in the curative population where transplant has largely been the standard of care for a long time.
So, Mike, any thoughts? Nobody's brought up LOXO-305. That's what I'm excited about because we've been talking about that in CLL now. But, Mike, again, what are you thinking about for the next year?
Well, I think that, we've already seen the movement away from cytotoxic therapy to upfront targeted agents and antibodies, et cetera, in CLL. I think we're going to see that more and more with a number of the subtypes of lymphoma, Waldenstrom, follicular, mantle cell in some cases. So I think we've got real opportunities to start shifting the whole approach to these diseases in the next year or two.
So here's the first issue that I want to talk about, and this could be practice changing, but we'll see how. So audience, here's the first poll question, kind of straightforward one that we've been asking for a long time. CNS prophylaxis with high dose methotrexate significantly reduces the rate of CNS relapse for patients with diffuse large B-cell at high risk for CNS relapse. You agree or disagree with that statement, or do you say there's no data to support that? And John Kay, I guess there were two big presentations, including this one here, that focused on that. First of all, how would you answer that question nowadays, John, after seeing some of the data presented at ASH?
You know, I think it's certainly in flux. We would have answered that question as believers of people giving high-dose methotrexate as prophylaxis, that it was a benefit. But I think when you get into the details of the data, they're pretty scarce. And, you know, both this and the study that followed it from Mike's group as well made the point that, looking at this retrospectively, it's really hard to tease out the benefit for the patients should they receive high-dose methotrexate prophylaxis.
So, Mike, the audience is unanimous on this. Just kidding. They're completely split between agree, disagree, no data, and I don't know. So that tells you then I guess we theoretically would need more data. You know, one thing that came out, and I'm curious if maybe you can talk a little bit about what we did learn at ASH, Mike, about this issue. But, you know, one of the things that you hear a lot about is the CNS IPI score, which I think really hasn't, at least I wasn't, been aware of it for that long. But it seemed to play out in this one study, and they reviewed some of the other approaches that have been tried, and they didn't really find any benefit. And I guess your group also. Can you kind of summarize where we are today, Mike, and what that means to your clinical practice?
Well, I would say that you know, it's been recognized for a long time that we don't have any prospective data to tell us what to do with patients at high risk for CNS relapse, and even those using the CNS IPI with the highest risk, they tend to be in the 15 to maybe 20% risk of actually developing a relapse. And both the over 1,000 patient retrospective study that was headed up by my colleagues, Dr. Orlan Anoya and Portel, as well as the retrospective data from, I think it was Alberta, you know, a very nice study that you had here, compared with the expected rates that intrathecal or high-dose methotrexate did not appear to really significantly reduce the number of CNS relapses. So so I think we had a long discussion about this in our ECOG lymphoma committee meeting last week. It will be a very challenging study to try to do, as you might imagine, you know, possibly adding, you know, having higher doses of an anti-CD20 might be helpful, adding lenalidomide. You know, there's maybe a signal in some of these that that may reduce the recurrence rates. But I think there's just a lot of work to be done here. And so our practice right now is that for the highest risk patients, we're still offering CNS prophylaxis, but with, you know, modified enthusiasm for sure.
So, Mike, just a quick follow-up from the chat room from Prashanth, who says, what about intrathecal methotrexate?
Yeah, so we've generally not used intrathecal methotrexate, aside from perhaps older patients that have paraspinous disease or they can't get high-dose methotrexate. We have used it there. But generally, we've tried to use, if we think somebody needs CNS prophylaxis, since the risk of relapse is both leptomeningeal and parenchymal, we've favored doing high-dose methotrexate if a patient could do it in the terms of renal function. So we have always preferred that, but now we have to question it.
So, John L., you know, it seems like everybody's trying to find a place for venetoclax and diffuse large B-cell, adding it to upfront R chemo, for example. This is an interesting paper at ASH, looking at venetoclax, rituximab, and polatuzumab. Any thoughts about it, John?
Oh, I think there's certainly interesting preclinical data. You have a slide up here highlights one piece of data supporting the use of venetoclax in large cell lymphoma. We also know that the least favorable group of large cell lymphomas includes BCL2. Particularly in the double hit scenario where you have BCL2 expression and or translocation. So it makes a lot of sense adding venetoclax. We know that it also adds toxicity. Whether there's some data out there with our CHOP, we have an intergroup study looking at our EPOC with venetoclax, and we know that there is more toxicity and dose modification. So ultimately, I think this is an interesting combination. The abstract that you mentioned looking at polatuzumab plus venetoclax plus rituximab, but ultimately, I think we really do need the randomized trials to show, since there is more toxicity, do we really get more efficacy? But certainly worthy of exploration.
So just to follow up, talking about randomized trial, I know there's a trial cooking out there with polatuzumab up front, a randomized phase 3 study, John L. Any thoughts about when that might be coming out and what do you think it's going to show?
Yeah, I think polatuzumab is clearly an active agent in various B-cell lymphomas. I think it's an interesting approach. My understanding, and I don't know all the details of that study, but I think it's still relatively early in its maturation. So I don't have any particular insight as to when it'll be out, but I expect it'll be some time. It wouldn't surprise me if it's positive with respect to PFS. ultimately, with large cell lymphoma, overall survival is a big issue as well. And we just have to see how the data go. It probably will be a little more toxic as well. So we'll have to see what that balance is. We've just seen this whole panel of lenalidomide studies in large cell lymphoma with similar kind of scenarios. So hopefully this one will be even better efficacy-wise, at least.
So, John Kay, we've been talking a lot about selinexor and myeloma. It's been interesting as I hear people talking about, you know, kind of figuring out ways to give it the patients have less side effects. And, of course, it's also an issue or an option in diffuse large B-cell. Like everybody's been saying, it seems like once you see something, people try to bring it up front. Any thoughts about selinexor in general and also this paper combining it with R-CHOP?
So it's a drug that does have single agent activity in relapsed refractory DLBCL, and it has a novel mechanism of action targeting exportin-1 or XPO1. The challenge was sorting out some of the toxicity around dosing, so both heme tox as well as issues with nausea and other GI symptoms that could largely be managed effectively with routine antiemetics. On the plus side, it's an oral agent in comparison to some of the other more recently approved IV drugs that are being given in DLBCL like Pola or tafasitamab. And so there's potential there to combine it, which I think is the goal as an oral agent to try and give it in combination with other established regimens and treatments. And so, you know, this study was a trial that needed to be done to look at it in combination with R-CHOP and so looked feasible. I think the challenge will be with that result and what looks like reasonable efficacy in a small number of patients. We'll see, can it be taken forward into a controlled trial to really establish it? The company is moving forward with a registrational trial that's opening internationally that will look at selinexor in combination with R-GEMOC or R-GDP, actually, in non-transplant eligible DLBCL.
So, Mike, any comments about selinexor as a single agent? I don't know if you've utilized it. One of the things we saw in myeloma initially when it was used, the monotherapy once a week, people had a lot of problems with tolerability. Then they started doing combinations with bortezomib. I'm sorry, it was twice a week. That was only once a week. And then with more aggressive support, I started to hear patients tolerating it pretty well. What's your experience been, Mike?
Now, our experience has been very limited with it. And we have had, issues. These patients, I think the context of the tolerability is it may be partly the drug, but in a good measure, it is that these are pretty beat up patients. A lot of times they're getting to this in the second, third line, or they've already failed a transplant. And they often have disease that's moving pretty rapidly. And so it's kind of a big ask for a single agent to get on top of that. And the response rates have been more modest than some of the other regimens. But I think bringing it a little more forward, maybe putting it in a modified schedule or dose with other agents might actually show a benefit that we don't see with the single agent.
So, John Kay, I'm also curious about your thoughts about tafasitamab. At ASH, we saw more follow-up from the L-MIND study. And then we also, as everybody's familiar, but then we saw also the concept of tafasitamab, lenalidomide, again, added to R-CHOP. Any thoughts, John Kay?
Yeah, so it's an interesting regimen, certainly. And the data that was initially shown by Jill Salen with follow-up now shows, favorable progression-free survival, and it looks like it's pretty well deliverable. I think the challenge is still, without a randomization there, it's really hard to understand the true increment of benefit for patients that are getting the regimen. The combination study, I think, with R-CHOP is something that needed to be done, obviously, to look at how effectively it could be delivered, either in combination with lenalidomide R-CHOP or just R-CHOP, and it looks feasible. And hopefully we'll see, again, a randomized trial, hopefully move the field forward again, potentially with that combination as well.
So we're going to go back and forth between some of the ASH data as well as some sort of general clinical concepts and sort of see where these new data are fitting in or changing things, if at all. So John L., we have this question for the audience. Audience, you have a patient, diffuse large B-cell, has progression after R-CHOP, but an older patient not eligible for high dose for a transplant or CAR T therapy, which of these therapies would you be most likely to utilize next? And this is what we asked when we asked the group, John, and a lot of people were saying the L-MIND regimen. A couple others brought up polatuzumab BR. John, any thoughts?
Well, it's very hard to compare because these choices, all of which are reasonable, haven't been compared head to head. So you're kind of comparing apples and oranges. And when you look at large cell lymphoma, across studies, you're going to get different patient populations with regard to who's more resistant. I think the Polo BR data show an overall survival benefit versus BR alone. So that certainly is interesting, although that's a small study. On the other hand, the tafasitamab lenalidomide data have data that, over 50% of people responding, and the durability is out approaching 2 years or so, which is pretty much better than we see with just about anything else. So that's what I lean toward in this choice, or at least as I sequence some of these agents, I would put selinexor a little lower. And, we're stretching CAR T-cell therapy into different patient populations, including older patients. So I think it's still not off the table for elderly relapsed large cell patients. And additionally, chemotherapy still has a role if the patient has some element of chemosensitivity to consider.
So the audience is also split, just like the faculty, between polatuzumab BR and tafasitamab lenalidomide. The art of oncology, I think, starts to come in here as well. We're going to move on now and talk about follicular lymphoma in terms of what happened at ASH. And Mike, mosunetuzumab, one of the most exciting, I think, developments in the field. Any thoughts about these data that was presented using this in follicular lymphoma?
Yeah, so this antibody is shown, as a bispecific. John Leonard highlighted up front that this is sort of a new direction with a number of these agents out there that are really quite promising. So these T-cell engaging bispecifics. Generally, pretty manageable to give, simpler in a lot of ways, of course, than a CAR. But as you're showing here, I think really, very solid responses.
So, and it seemed like pretty durable responses. So, Mike, though, what do you see in terms of, CAR T-like side effects, CRS, neurologic problems with this agent?
Yeah. Well, I don't have personal experience with it, but those certainly can still, occur. And my colleagues may have a better sense of how they compare with a CAR. I think the data that you just showed us will be bumping up against, although not in a randomized way as yet, but some pretty impressive data for CAR T responses in relapsed follicular, showing very high response rates and good durability out to 1 to 2 years.
So John Kay getting a couple of good questions here from the chat room. Somebody wants to know about using tafasitamab after CAR T. Do we know anything about that in terms of response rate?
Very limited data. And I think, there is a bit of a hypothetical concern there, maybe not so hypothetical, around antigen expression with CD19. And so we know at least that's one of the mechanisms when you re-biopsy patients after CAR failure that you can see antigen loss. And in lymphoma patients, that may be as high as a third to, maybe 40% of patients. And if that's the case, you're not expecting as much activity from an anti-CD19 directed antibody, though, again, it is being given with lenalidomide. So that would be the concern.
So just to continue, another question from the chat room, John Kay. How many different bispecifics are there, and are there differences between them?
Yeah, so there are, I think, at least four of them at last count in terms of varying bispecific antibodies being developed in lymphoma. And I think it's important to realize that at least for all of them, there are different approaches that have been taken in terms of how toxicity may be mitigated, potentially the use of a anti-CD20 depletion with one of the products before you then proceed with dosing of the the drug. The ramp up may be different in terms of split dosing during the first cycle. There may be advantages with one of the antibodies that can be now given subcutaneously, and that may mitigate some of the toxicity and may make it a little easy for delivery in the clinic or in the hospital. They've not been compared head-to-head, obviously, so I think there's still a lot of room to look to improve the platform, both from a toxicity standpoint, where I think a lot of the differences are being focused now, as well as with efficacy.
So just to follow up on your issue about antigen loss with CD19, Pamela in the chat room wants to know, but why are you concerned about loss of CD19 but not CD20?
Well, I guess, you know, here with a CD19-directed CAR and with tafasitamab being a CD19-directed naked antibody, that's the concern. I think broadly, when you start to look at CD20 loss, it's probably not something we've thought quite as much about in DLBCL. And when you look at studies where you're systematically rebiopsying people, that probably happens a little more often than we think. One of the issues as well that comes up is, you know, just to acknowledge it, Neil, is a little bit of this is going to depend on the technique that you're using on the specimen, right? We know immuno isn't quite as sensitive, and so you may miss low-level antigen detection with immuno, but you'll find it with flow and more sensitive techniques.
So Mike Padmaja in the chat room has an interesting thought. Would using tafasitamab affect the ability to proceed with CAR-T or L-mine, you know, because of the lenalidomide in terms of harvesting cells?
So my understanding from both colleagues and from some of the reading that lenalidomide does not, so far as I know, really necessarily impair CAR-T collection. I think the problem with TAFA, if you're anticipating going to a CAR, is the same issue that John just brought up, that you may have antibody, you know, left behind that will, in fact, block CAR binding to the tumor cells.
So, John, I know you're the, I want to go to you about this next issue. Now, I've got to say, tazemetostat, you guys have got some nice generics names coming out now. I kind of like them. Tazemetostat has a nice ring to it, John, but I know you've had a lot of experience with it. Can you talk about some of the data that was presented at ASH by you and others?
Sure. So probably easier just to call it Taz.
Make it easier. Yeah. Even better.
And it's not the Tasmanian devil. It's a good treatment, I think, for some patients. So this is an inhibitor of EZH2. EZH2 is involved in germinal center B-cell lymphomas primarily. And at least so far, that's where the data are, in follicular lymphoma and in, to a lesser extent, germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, though it's being looked at in other settings, and there are other EZH2 inhibitors out there. Somewhere between 10 and 20% of follicular lymphoma patients have EZH2 mutations. If you have relapsed follicular lymphoma and you have the mutated subtype, as you see on the slide you have in front, pretty high response rate, somewhere around 70% or so patients responding. Whereas the wild type, which is the majority of patients, somewhere around 35%. So I would say meaningful, but clearly less. And the durability is in the range of about a year. So this is an approved drug, particularly for the EZH2 mutated follicular lymphoma patients who have had prior therapy, also available for patients with a wild type who don't have other suitable options. And we're looking at this now in a randomized trial. There's some preclinical and other rationale to add it to the R-squared lenalidomide rituximab regimen. So we are pursuing this in a randomized phase 3 trial, R-squared versus R-squared tazemetostat.
So Prashant in the chat room asked the question. I feel like every day, every kind of cancer we talk about, you get a question like this, which is, how do you look for these EZH2 mutation? I mean, almost it seems like every time we do a program, there's some kind of marker that they have to figure out what to send for. So, John, how do you get this assay done?
Yeah, so there are now commercial assays out there that have this included, certain institutional panels. If you use Foundation Medicine or any of the commercial ones, they will also include EZH2 there. So it's worth talking to your pathologist. I'm interestingly off protocol when this was approved. The first patient I tested had the mutation when I looked for it with our pathologist. So it's becoming more and more, particularly now that we have a drug that can be influenced by it.
So I want to ask you one other question about TAS, but first, audience, so can you mull on this question, and we'll get to that in a second. What's your usual upfront therapy for a patient with FL, 78-year-old woman who has and requires treatment for stage 3 FL? And looks like most people are saying VR. But one more point about TAS, John, is the issue. You kind of mentioned the issue of using in patients who are wild type. First of all, is it? I don't think it's approved in wild type. And what kind of situations would you do that, John?
Well, the approval is for wild type patients who don't have other suitable options.
Right, so I think
you have to look at, and the package insert is kind of worded carefully. So I don't want to be mistaken about that. You can take a look at it if you're thinking about it for a patient. And obviously, it's going to be influenced by reimbursement. But, you know, I think a patient who's been through chemotherapy, lenalidomide, may or may not have had a prior PI3 kinase inhibitor. Those are patients where I'd at least be thinking about considering it for use.
Yeah, I'm in a little bit of trouble advancing the slides, but that's okay. We can just talk. We'll be like on rounds here for a second. Getting back to this issue, though, we asked the audience, first-line therapy for follicular lymphoma. Mike, the audience mostly said BR, but a substantial minority said either R-squared or O-bendamustine, interestingly. How do you think through upfront therapy in older patients like this? Mike, I guess, well, we can't show the slide right now, but how do you approach it, Mike?
Well, so I have to say I'm very cautious about, for a disease like this, follicular, it's not going to be a curable disease, really, and in a 78-year-old, I want to be careful. You think about comorbidities, et cetera. With bulky disease, I mean, if there was non-bulky disease and they needed treatment, a single agent antibody, I think, is quite reasonable. Bendamustine certainly has good activity, and I think that's reasonable paired with either antibody. But if I'm starting in somebody 78, even if they have normal renal function, I really drop that initial dose of benda down. I usually start with 60 because sometimes in older patients, you can just get a real protracted degree of marrow suppression, so you have to be careful about that. I think I was an outlier on that case when we discussed it at ASH, because I would, you know, we've got head-to-head data for R chemo versus R squared in the frontline setting, and they looked equivalent. And so I think R squared is a reasonable approach. So lenalidomide rituximab is something I would consider in a patient like this. Not that lenalidomide doesn't have its own side effect profile in older patients, so there's caution there as well.
What about lenalidomide obinutuzumab, Mike?
You know, there's activity there. Sometimes my experience when I've added obinutuzumab to either len or to benda, you see some additional cytopenia, especially neutropenia. So again, I think you just have to be cautious. But there's no reason to think, just like tafa len and rituximab len, there's synergy between those, an anti-CD20, CD19 antibody and lenalidomide, because it stabilizes that effector cell, NK cell binding to the antibody labeled follicular lymphoma cell to give you that cytotoxic or apoptotic inducing action.
So what about second line therapy, John Kay? You know, often these patients with FL are getting first line BR. How do you think about patients who relapse after that second line?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing to consider there is time to relapse, right? And so we focused a lot on the patients that tend to have earlier relapse. And so those are the patients that we are tending to see in our practices, though certainly people that had R chemo a number of years ago may be experiencing later relapse. And so the first consideration, if the time to relapse is early, is to re-biopsy and exclude transformation, because you may approach therapy there, you know, certainly in a different manner, emphasizing an anthracycline for sure, and then potentially the role of a stem cell transplant in eligible patients. In patients with later relapse, I think still the principle should be to retreat with an anti-CD20 based regimen and maybe not try to recycle the same type of therapy. And so that's maybe where, depending on drug availability, if they've had bendamustine before, you can look at adding in a drug like lenalidomide. again, if they've had a long enough interval from rituximab, going back to R would be reasonable. And then certainly in the R refractory population, that's where the Gadolin data would demonstrate obinutuzumab is the preferred base to build another regimen with.
Why don't we talk a little bit about mantle cell? And Mike, we saw a lot of really interesting data there. To start out with, we saw a trial looking at, we know that R squared is a regimen that is often used, or lenalidomide is often used in recurrent mantle cell. So Mike, what about this study that looked at, and we're going to talk about some of the other things that were reported at ASH, looking at mantle cell, lenalidomide being added in upfront, and also the issue of MRD. There are a couple of papers in ASH. It's starting to sound a little bit like CLL nowadays, Mike, using MRD.
Yeah, well, with regard to MRD, there was data presented that reinforced earlier studies that showed that achieving MRD negativity in mantle cell lymphoma does correlate with an improved outcome, so a much longer duration of remission. So it's still not, I think, ready for prime time in practice, but I think as we move forward, it may well become a standard like we're using now for CLL, where we're trying to define an endpoint that allows limited duration therapy. So that's that's a consideration there. And lenalidomide rituximab R squared, both in the relapse setting and in frontline in mantle cell, John Leonard's colleague Gia Ruan has published a couple of updates of her study of that in the frontline. Very, very impressive response rates and durability of response rates, including some patients MRD negative for many years. And what's interesting is that, whereas some of the adverse prognostic factors, like a high MIPI score and the high proliferation index by Ki-67 that are relevant when you're giving R chemo, became less relevant or not at all predictive of response to R squared. So it's a reminder that these prognostic markers that we use are really prognostic only in the context of the treatment being applied. And so that's where some non-cytotoxic approaches may actually have a benefit.
And just to follow up, Mike, it's interesting in CLL for a long time, investigators, when I'd say, do you think the docs in practice should be doing MRD? They felt pretty strongly no. Now you're starting to hear them when they talk about cases, they're using MRD to make decisions. Same thing in myeloma. What about a mantle cell, Mike? Is it worth doing in practice right now or too soon?
I think it's a little soon, and I think it depends on how we're going to look at MRD. But there are some studies that will be coming out, some phase three or randomized phase twos that are going to be coming out from U.S. and Canadian groups that I think will help us, will define that role a bit more. And, I'd say in mantle cell, the most important MRD-driven study right now is the one being done by the cooperative groups, where patients with upfront mantle cell lymphoma who are transplant eligible are getting whatever induction regimen provider wants to give, but then they can enroll in the study. They get MRD testing, and if they're MRD positive, they all go to an auto transplant and maintenance Ritux. If they are MRD negative, then that's the randomization to either an auto followed by maintenance or just maintenance Ritux alone. So I think that's going to tell us whether, if you've achieved a really deep MRD negative response with induction, you may not need that consolidated transplant.
That story's been out there in myeloma for a while. People kind of back and forth about whether or not you can hold transplant MRD negative. Mike, a couple of questions from the chat room. Got our slides cooking again, thankfully, but a couple of questions. Have you seen pleural pericardial effusion with mantle cell? What's your preferred upfront regimen for a young, fit patient with mantle cell, Mike?
Right. So our preferred upfront regimen right now is to use the ECOG 4181 study that Nina Wagner Johnson is leading. So that is comparing bendamustine Ritux for three cycles, followed by three cycles of high dose Ara-C, or the same regimen plus Acala or BR plus Acala as induction. So we try to get any transplant eligible patient or some, eligible anyway for high-dose ARC onto that study. Outside of that, what we have been using in recent years is the study from the French group where we use our DHACs, so rituximab, dex, high-dose ARC, and we tend to use oxaliplatinum for four cycles, so no alkylator, no anthracycline, and then we take them to an auto transplant outside of a study. So that's our front line right now.
And pleural pericardial fusion of mantle cell, Mike?
Fortunately, don't see it all that often, but mantle cell does have a predilection for involving any array of extranodal sites. And so we manage them with systemic therapy of choice for that individual and what they're going to be able to tolerate.
So back to Ash and John L. again, I was all excited when I saw this LOXO 305 in mantle cell because I've been excited about it in CLL. Any comments, John? Looks like a pretty good waterfall plot.
So this is a BTK inhibitor, and we've got several that are approved both for CLL and mantle cell. The difference here, or a difference here, is that it's a non-covalent BTK inhibitor. Now, why that's different, I would say there's a bit of hand-waving. I'm interested if the CLL people who have looked at this had any good ideas. But there's some rationale that non-covalent could be better than covalent, could give better coverage. The net is that this drug has a similar toxicity profile at a high level to the other BTK inhibitors, but it works in people where the other BTK inhibitors are no longer working. So it works in BTK-resistant disease. And you see that in the bottom part of the slide here in patients who were pretreated with a BTK inhibitor. And again, some of these are toxicity, but most of these are progression. You see that it's got a 52% response rate. Some patients that are now out over 6 months to a year, obviously the devil's in the details, but to be able to treat a patient with a BTK inhibitor when a previous BTK inhibitor didn't work so well, I think is quite interesting. The question is going to be, does this push down other things lower on the list, like CAR T cells that we have now in mantle cell? Will we use this earlier in the course of the disease? Will you save this, or will you use it as your first BTK inhibitor, or will you save it for the second? All these are things we need to sort out, but I think these data are very interesting and certainly suggest that this has advantages efficacy-wise to some of the other agents that we're already using in practice. So we'll see where all that goes.
Yeah, I mean, the tolerability, I mean, what I'm hearing is pretty clean tolerability, particularly compared to ibrutinib. Yeah. So audience, just kind of curious about your second line therapy for an older patient with mantle cell who gets BR and R maintenance up front and then relapses several years later. I'm curious to see how they would approach this question, particularly if they use a BTK inhibitor, which looks like almost everybody is, a little bit of R squared, but which one? And looks like Acala is leading the league, so to speak. John Kay, you and your colleague Laurie Sen put down ibrutinib, but I think you were thinking, we like to say cost and reimbursement issues aside, because I think until recently you hadn't been able to get anything except ibrutinib. So actually, Anne says zanubrutinib. That's interesting. Everybody else says Acala. But John, if you could get one of the other ones, Acala or Zana, would you be using it?
It's nice to have the options, Neil. I think the thing I'd like to highlight on the pro side of ibrutinib is still the longer-term follow-up is there, and so you can be a little more confident, I think, about looking at later PFS, et cetera. You know, that being said, the toxicity profile of the other two drugs, you know, certainly looks like they're different and could be better. And so, you know, comfort level is growing with both of them. And I think acalabrutinib certainly would be a reasonable choice. We haven't had the chance to work with zanubrutinib yet in Canada. And so, again, the toxicity profile looks good there, and that would be another good alternative.
So another question, I just want to kind of take the pulse of you faculty on John L., is the use of venetoclax in mantle cell. When we asked the faculty where they use it, everybody says yes, but then there's a question of after what. Most people are now saying maybe after a BTK inhibitor. But a couple people, including you, say lenalidomide first. But John, in general, what have you seen with venetoclax in terms of efficacy? How do you approach the issue of TLS?
So I think TLS is not as much of a problem as it is in CLL. So I think we tend to be a little more aggressive in the dose escalation as far as the timing, partly because we're using it in people where there's less TLS, more resistant disease, partly because of the nature of mantle cell. I would say that most of the time when I'm using it is using venetoclax, it's after a BTK inhibitor, often adding it in. Where someone's got some slow progression on a BTK inhibitor, so we add in the venetoclax to see if we can restore some sensitivity there. That being said, it's hard to know how well that works. Sometimes it works a bit, sometimes it doesn't. And as we referred to the Loxo drug earlier, I think that may be a place where I would be switching in the future to the Loxo drug. Additionally, we now have CAR T cells. So I think CAR T cells for patients who have BTK inhibitor resistant mantle cell certainly is becoming more and more a preferred option.
And we're going to get to CAR T in the end of this, but when we ask people, what do they do after BTK, or we said ibrutinib, almost everybody said CAR T, and we'll talk about that in a second. Certainly one of the most exciting areas, I think, in mantle cell for sure right now. But we also saw some data from Hodgkin lymphoma at the ASH meeting. And John Kay, we saw follow-up from the Echelon 1 study. Any thoughts about what was seen there? It looks like the benefit was maintained. And they also reported some data on pregnancies, which I thought was really interesting, particularly in Hodgkin's with younger patients. So any thoughts about this update, John?
Yeah, so I guess two comments, Neil. So, you know, firstly, it is nice to see the five-year follow-up. You're seeing those plateaus on that curve continue and still about 7% benefit in terms of traditional progression-free survival is presented on that curve, as the audience can see. So that does likely appear to be a 7% improvement in cure rate. And that's an important finding. In terms of the toxicity data, we hadn't had a lot of data looking at patients that have received BV up front. And I think the data around pregnancy fertility is certainly a concern and reassuring now that we don't see a signal that BV may be an issue there. And as we think about how to integrate the data, again, we have been increasingly using risk-adapted approaches using PET after two cycles of ABVD and potentially escalating patients after PET positivity there to BCOP based on the UK RAFL data. That does create issues because you're still exposing up to 20% of the patients to a regimen that is associated with a higher rate of infertility, such as BCOP. And so the advantage here with Echelon 1 is this was not a risk-adapted approach, even though, again, many trials have used risk-adapted approaches as a standard now, and they are being largely integrated into frontline management.
So, John L., at ASH, we also saw some follow-up from really interesting work. We've seen a number of trials looking at older patients with HL, and this was a study we saw more data on looking at bevacizumab and alone and in combination. From your take, what was the bottom line? This is the summary of what their take. I was surprised at how active BV was.
Yeah, I think a challenge is what do you do with these older patients? You don't want to give them bleomycin because of the toxicity. They may not be able to tolerate an anthracycline. This study looked at BV alone. It looked at it in combination with a couple of other options, DTIC, with bendamustine, with nivolumab, all of which had 90% response rates. The durability was a little bit variable there and not huge numbers of patients, but it certainly suggests that starting with BV, whether it's alone or in combination, is a reasonable strategy. That being said, upfront elder patients with Hodgkin's are treated kind of all over the map. And I think until we get some randomized data, it's really like it is with a number of things with older patients. We just kind of, the feel of your clinical judgment and what the patient can tolerate is driving things. But BV seems to be a good part of it.
Yeah, I was surprised, it is a small number of patients, but you see this 92% response rate with BV alone. I was thinking, I'm used to much lower response rates in the relapse setting. It seems like it's more active up front. Is that your take, John?
Yeah, it's about 70% in the relapse setting, give or take. So 90% single agent is reasonable. Maybe. maybe there's some patient selection there a little bit because a bulk of disease or something. But, you know, at the end of the day, the question is, are these curative for these patients? And I think it's hard to say, but certainly worthy of further study. And, you know, Andy Evans has looked at BV plus kind of AVD combinations also. And I think that's another approach people are adapting with some sort of sequencing of that combination as well.
So we also saw some data, of course, in the past. We had the Athera trial looking at BV after transplant. But Mike, now we're seeing Nevo plus BV in that same space. And these are the data. I mean, indirectly, it looks like it's really adding something. Any thoughts about this, Mike? How is this being viewed?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know what the sort of the broader response to this data is, but it clearly shows activity, you know, with, you know, with the combination. And John Kay has contributed a lot in this, not necessarily in the maintenance setting, but in the front line, it's proving to be a very active regimen.
John, how have you been approaching the issue of BV consolidation after transplant? And I don't know whether you're starting to see patients who've had BV up front as part of the echelon approach. Do you still use it post-transplant maintenance? Would you consider adding Nevo to it?
So we have been. I think the challenge there will be, firstly, the advantage of using BV up front in a study like Echelon 1 is that the exposure was limited. I'd say in the patient with early failure or primary refractory disease to a BV-based regimen like that, it's hard to imagine there would be a lot of benefit to using the drug as consolidation. But for a patient with a relapse, you know, certainly beyond a year and maybe even 6 months, it would make sense. They're higher risk, and the Athera study demonstrated the benefit of consolidation in high risk. I think where it becomes more of a challenge is when you start to parse the data down a little bit. And so if patients are in a CR to their salvage therapy, the subgroup analysis suggests potentially less benefits in that group getting consolidation. And, you know, increasingly in the environment where BV may be given as part of the salvage strategy, whether it's with drugs like Nevo or with chemotherapy, we have no data looking at consolidation with BV afterwards, though it would certainly make sense. So I think this is the last standard opportunity to cure these patients. And so for that reason, I would probably favor trying to be as aggressive to have disease control as you can.
So John L., your group reported, I was kind of surprised to see this. Of course, we've been talking about CC486 for a while in the last year or so now, and AML in our post-ASH AML program. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this as maintenance after 7+3. But I wasn't aware it was being looked at in lymphomas. You had this paper, of course, it's oral azacitidine, essentially, in peripheral T-cell lymphoma. What's the bottom line there, John? And any thoughts about this moving forward?
Sure. Hypomethylating agents seem to be chemosensitizing both in large cell lymphoma, B-cell large cell lymphoma, as well as in T-cell lymphoma. Some of that work has come out of my colleague, Leandro Cercetti, here at Weill Cornell's work. And there are some French data showing that in peripheral T-cell lymphoma, particularly angioimmunoblastic subtype, that there's about a 50% response rate of oral azacitidine in relapse patients with these PTCL subsets. In particular, AITL seems to be associated with TET2 mutations. TET2 is involved in DNA methylation. So there's a link that a hypomethylating agent may work. So we looked at this in a small group of patients with T-cell lymphoma, seemed to work better in patients that had TET2 mutations. So it kind of fit that hypothesis. Obviously needs more study, but we've had a series of drugs added to CHOP in T-cell lymphoma. There was a negative study from the French that looked at romidepsin CHOP, didn't show a benefit in a phase 3 trial. So we keep looking to try to improve upon CHOP or CHOEP in upfront T-cell lymphoma. We'll see if this one has legs. I'll mention that the intergroup in the U.S. has got a randomized trial getting started within a couple of months using this combination, CHOP plus oral azacitidine, or duvelisib with a CHOP, a PI3 kinase inhibitor as well. So a randomized study. So we'll try to take that forward.
Wow, interesting. So, Micah, we were talking about the older patient, and we presented to the faculty an 85-year-old patient who was not a candidate for aggressive chemotherapy. And we see the faculty or the has a variety of responses to this, BV alone, BV with something else. How do you say BV alone, Mike? What are your thoughts about that? Why is that your approach?
Well, I think in an elderly, frail patient, I think I like to make them prove to me that something simpler is not going to be enough to control symptoms and control disease. Realizing that any of these are likely to have a lot of maybe more disproportionate toxicity. You have to be very cautious about peripheral neuropathy, et cetera. But, at least I try to start with the single agent, see how they do through, the first, 3 to 4 cycles, and then add on if need be to control disease.
So we want to finish out now and talk about CAR T therapy in lymphomas, including, of course, diffuse large B cell, and in terms of what we saw. So, John Kay, pretty interesting paper I've heard people chatting about, shall we say, doing an indirect comparison of the three available agents in diffuse large B cell. Pretty interesting approach. All kinds of ways to indirectly compare data other than just, what's it look like to you? But I like the idea there's some rigor in this. Can you talk a little bit about what was done here and what led to these conclusions?
Yeah, so the methodology for these are always challenging. And I think as a clinician, it's you always look at them with a bit of a grain of salt, particularly in the absence of the true randomized data that we'd want to see to make better decisions for patients. So what was done is the study data for the three trials were available, individual patient data available for the liso-cel data from the Transcend study. And then a group of clinicians internationally were asked to rank baseline characteristics that they felt were important in terms of assessing efficacy and toxicity. So that whittled down list was then used to match the populations, and that would have included things like bridging therapy, bulk disease, other risk factors from baseline factors that would have been on when the patients went into the study. And then ultimately the comparison was made around efficacy and toxicity between the three products based on the phase two studies that were done. Now, in the end, it sort of looked like what people might have thought based on an unadjusted comparison. So it looks like there is, a trend towards maybe a little less efficacy from tisagenlecleucel, where again, there were some challenges during the accrual of the study, given some manufacturing issues early on. And for both of the 4-1BB products, so that's liso-cel and tisagenlecleucel, it looked like there was potentially a little bit of improvement in terms of safety with lower rates of neurotoxicity in particular, which could be seen with a 4-1BB co-stimulated product.
So again, we're having a few problems with our slides, but Mike, hopefully you'll be able to see it, but if not, you can check out the slide deck. We were talking about CAR T and mantle cell, and at ASH, we saw follow-up on the ZUMA-2 study, a multi-center registrational study of KTEX-19 in mantle cell. Can you talk about what we saw there at ASH and where we stand right now in terms of efficacy and tolerability in patients with mantle cell, Mike?
Yeah, the updated data showed that something on the order of, I think, 80-85% of people with relapsed mantle cell, relapsed refractory responded, and there were about 60% overall who achieved a CR. And looking out now at least to a year and some patients beyond that, ongoing remission rates, especially if you get a CR up front to the CAR, then the majority of those patients had ongoing and apparently fairly durable responses. So encouraging. A little longer follow-up is going to be needed, but so far it's quite promising.
What about cytokine release and neurologic problems, John Kay, in patients with mantle cell? Any different the way it plays out, for example, compared to a diffuse large B cell?
So I'd say in general, there wasn't much of a signal that way. I think the reassuring thing is that as you know, the clinicians and teams looking after these patients on studies have really learned the ins and outs of managing, you know, CRS and neurotoxicity. You see that with probably earlier intervention now than what was done in the early days of the phase two studies, we're starting to see probably a little more steroid and tocilizumab use and maybe less development of grade three or grade four toxicity from intervening earlier. It's still a work in evolution, because it does seem like if people have less tumor bulk going into the studies as well, they're less set up for some of the toxicity that we may see later as well. So it does make all of this very difficult to compare across trials.
Interesting. So, John L., we started to see some data at ASCO on CAR T in follicular lymphoma, and we saw some more at ASH, both with TIS in the ALARA trial and AXI in the ZUMA 5 trial. Where do we stand right now, John, in terms of CAR T and FL? And in what situations, if any, right now, would you be thinking about trying to get a patient on a trial?
Both of these studies had data with response rates over in the 90% range. The toxicity profile in the ballpark of what we've seen in other settings. So you have to figure that into the equation. I think that and efficacy, you know, the durability is the issue. We have a little more data from the ZUMA 5 study as far as longer follow-up, but still in the scheme of follicular lymphoma, we're still, you know, talking about 2-3 years of follow-up. So it's hard to say for sure long-term. I would say somebody who I'd be thinking about a transplant in is where I would be doing CAR T cells or thinking about CAR T cells, perhaps instead of a transplant or after an auto transplant, maybe instead of an allo transplant. But so we're really talking about multiply refractory patients who are, and the transformed patients is probably the biggest group where we're seeing that done as well.
I'm just kind of curious, John L., just to follow up on that, what kind of condition does a patient need to be in to go into CAR T? You know, I think some people assumed it was kind of comparable to patient, say, going to transplant, autologous transplant. And then I've heard other people say, well, maybe not. It can do older patients who are, you know, not as great a condition.
Yeah, I would agree with that point. You know, certainly if a patient can get an auto transplant, they can get CAR T cells. I think it goes beyond that, though. There are some data with older patients. The conditioning chemotherapy really has to be is less with CAR T. So it's, you know, generally a fludarabine, Flu-Cy type regimen, which most people can handle. I think the biggest thing is being able to tolerate the possibility of cytokine release and neurotoxicity. But there are data with patients in their 75-80 year range, in some cases, getting CAR T successfully. So I wouldn't necessarily rule it out.